Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH. We are streaming this Friday afternoon on the KTTH smartphone app. City of Portland took two steps forward, but then, of course, at least one step back, and that is what's trending.
What's trending? The homelessness crisis.
Mayor Ted Wheeler is now introducing a new approach to homelessness, giving up on a ban of outdoor encampments during the day. And it's not, in fairness, it's not entirely his fault. He had to deal with some legal issues. But this new proposal would put some limits on what homeless people can do while they're camping on public property. So they're still saying, yeah, fine, you'll be allowed to camp here, but we're not going to allow you to do certain things. Now, the time of day or location is not specified, meaning it doesn't matter when you're doing this, you're going to be able to camp out. However, they say with this initial or with this new proposal that if you violate the rules three times, you will be fined up to $100 or face up to 30 days in jail. What they're doing here is saying you can't, while camping out, build a fire, use a propane heater, dig into the ground, or dismantle and sell bicycles, which they see happening all the time. But then we're supposed to pretend that it's not stolen bicycles. It's just theirs. They spent their life's the last several months of their life as they've been asking people for money and definitely not using the money for drugs. They've been saving up for a new Schwinn bike or Schwinn, whatever it's called.
What this ordinance does is it restores some of the law enforcement tools for people who say, hey, you've offered me shelter, but I'm not going to take it, or I'm just going to dig in right here and I'm not going to abide by reasonable manner restrictions. We then also have those law enforcement tools to enforce the law if we need to.
Now, I guarantee you that there's going to be some group that comes out and says, what do you mean they can't build a fire? So you want them to freeze to death? You can't do that. That's illegal. I'm sure that'll happen next. That's the Ted Wheeler. That's the Mayor Ted Wheeler talking with Coin News out in Portland. And he believes that this at least is going to take us in another direction of addressing this issue after it got so bad because of people like, wait for it, Ted Wheeler.
So you're right that at the end of the day, we need more zero to low income housing. But what we also know is that the longer people are on our streets, the more likely they are to become addicted to opioids and the more likely they are to develop serious behavioral health issues.
He's, of course, right. Now, the reason why he's doing this is because the last time they put out their homeless encampment ban, it was at least day ban. It was in conflict with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling back in 2018 out of Idaho that said you can't penalize people for sleeping outside on public property if there's not enough shelter space available for them at the, you know, at the ask, at the asking point. And the irony in all of this, even though it's something, maybe it's not one step back, it's one tiny step forward, but not the giant leap that you had hoped for. This is almost certainly going to be moot in just a few months, or not even, I don't even think it will take that long. You might get a ruling fairly quickly. April 22nd is when the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear Grants Pass Johnson, I think it is. And that assumption is that the U.S. Supreme Court, the conservatives, will stick together on this and say the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here is absurd. You've got to give the power to municipalities to determine their own homeless rules. It's silly to say, just as a blanket statement, you can't allow people to be swept from public spots unless there's shelter space available. It doesn't matter for some of them. You can offer some of these people all the shelter in the world and they're going to say no. So how exactly is that a fair approach for cities to take towards creating their own homelessness policies? It just does not make any sense whatsoever. But rather than do nothing, I guess, the mayor stepped forward with this new proposal. It will replace, God, Friday. I said replace. Oh my God. Maybe I'm just annoyed. I've been annoyed all day today. It's Friday and I didn't get a haircut. I don't get a haircut on every other Friday. And so that already puts me in a bad mood. I got booted or bumped from my hit this morning on Fox because of the dumb earthquake, which we'll talk about in a second. And, you know, just got me off on the wrong foot this morning. And then someone forgot to tell producer Jackson, brand new producer Jackson, that it was okay to make eye contact with me. And he made eye contact with me two times today, which is just absurd. He learned his lesson, though. I'm looking at him now, and he's cowering. He said, lesson learned. I told him to have a conversation with our 11-year-old intern, Duncan, and he did. And now things are all set. He won't even make eye contact with me now, and I'm looking at him, and I'm okay with that. I'm kidding, sort of. So, you know, I guarantee you, no matter what happens, this is going to get protested. This is going to face some legal challenge. And again, it will all be moot. It will all be moot because the Supreme Court's going to allow cities to do what it is they need to do, at least within reason. I can't imagine on a case like that, they're going to come up with the most narrow of readings of the law. I just think they're going to give a blanket. Okay, you guys get to decide what you do. And if you violate anyone's legitimate civil rights, as clearly outlined, okay, we'll have another conversation in a courtroom. But as of right now, go ahead and do your sweeps. Because we understand what's on the line. We understand what's at stake. We understand the implications of allowing these encampments to sort of grow and grow and grow, particularly in the context of not just a crime crisis, but an overdose fatality crisis. And a lot of these folks, they are dying out on the streets. That is not compassionate. In fact, one might argue that's the exact opposite of compassion, to allow someone to continue to use their drug of choice until they ultimately die on the streets, on a sidewalk or on a park bench. It's depressing the more you think about it. But again, we're in this world because Democrats chose it. They made the choice. Let's find out what else is trending. I'll be honest, and I'm not offended by something that Hillary Franz tweeted. She's the land commissioner, public lands commissioner here in Washington State. She's also running for Congress. I'm not offended by what she wrote on Twitter. I'm not mad. I'm just a little bit confused. So this morning, I just mentioned it. We had a 4.8 magnitude earthquake in New York and New Jersey. It actually struck the White House station, New Jersey, at, I think, 10:23 a.m., their time. And, you know, if you live on the East Coast, you are one of the millions of people who was taken completely by surprise because earthquakes are exceptionally rare, very, very, very rare on the East Coast. In fact, according to Kathy Hochul, she said that it was one of the largest East Coast earthquakes in the last century. Now, thankfully, maybe luckily, there were no reports of widespread damage, no injuries that we're aware of. Just a lot of people who are pretty shaken up. And the pun was intended. It wasn't, but I thought in the moment, now I should just take credit for it. But about 90 minutes later, you got a post from Hillary Franz, and I legitimately don't understand it. It just says 4.8 dot, 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 cute. 4.8 cute. So why in the world... Seriously, why in the world would she say that? And what is she trying to say? Because if we got hit with a 4.8 earthquake in Seattle or Spokane and Tacoma, like if the epicenter was near any of those cities, it would kind of be a big deal, would it not? 4.8? I would argue here that would be a pretty big deal. We don't get a lot of 4.8 earthquakes here. And that you're going to feel. And so if that's a big deal, and we would all treat it as a big deal, including every single news outlet, the ones that will prop up Hillary Franz's campaign for Congress. If it's a big deal here, why wouldn't it be a big deal for an area that has a bunch of people who have never experienced an earthquake before? Seriously. Now, I'm not against anyone making a joke, even a bad one. I mean, look, in this case, it would be symbolic of her congressional campaign. It's a total joke. And again, I'm not offended at all. I'm just trying to figure out what was the point of this. Is she oddly bragging that we deal with much more violent earthquakes? Because we don't. Is she saying we wouldn't take to social media to talk about the experience of a 4.8 earthquake for all of us, we would in a heartbeat. Twitter is filled with people saying dumb things about things they experienced. So what exactly was the point? It was also odd to me, given how seriously we're asked to take the annual Great Washington Shakeout. Some businesses cooperate with this, where they essentially say, and I don't remember the date, but at a specific time, on a specific day, we have the Washington State Great Shakeout, in which businesses will do a drill of a simulated earthquake experience. So everyone will get under their desks when an internal alarm goes off, or, you know, someone gets on the intercom and says, okay, drill time, there's an earthquake. Blah, 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 blah. That blah, 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 is how you make the noise of shaking. Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's kind of a waste of time. Sorry. I know what I'm from California. I lived in Northridge I lived in LA for the Northridge earthquake. I ended up moving to Northridge, but that was awful, as at least as seen through the eyes of however old I was at that, 13 maybe? No, I'm around then. It was maybe younger. I mean, I'm 29, so I didn't experience it. Sorry, I made that all up. But that was terrifying. That was scary. So I guess I don't understand why I have to go through a shakeout. I know what to do. You get under the desk. For me, it's getting under the desk. And I am nudged into participating in this because of tweets like Hillary Franz sending out, or what she sent out, telling me, okay, it's time for the Great Shakeout. We're here for you, blah, 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 blah. But given we almost never have large earthquakes here, you know, now I feel inspired by Hillary Franz. The next time she or anybody else tells me about the Great Shakeout, I'll just say, why do I want to waste 10 minutes simulating an earthquake response? Cute. If we just add cute to the end of everything, does that work? So silly. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The economy.
We certainly had some good news today when it came to the economy. There's no doubt whatsoever about it. We had about 303,000 jobs get added to March, which was a lot more than they expected. Now, whether they revise those numbers down like they've had a tendency to do under Biden, not just under Biden, but they certainly seem to have a lot of that kind of action happening under Biden. But assuming that doesn't happen, let's just say that these are real jobs. That's obviously good. You had unemployment dipping down to 3.8, which is why the acting labor secretary, Julie Hsu, is so optimistic about the economy.
When you have strong leadership, when you have experience in the White House, and you have economic policies that really invest in people and invest in jobs here in the United States, you can have this kind of economic growth.
Wow, thank you so much, speaking with CBS News in a way that did not seem like she was just pumping up the guy who's up for re-election so she can keep her job. Bankrate.com senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick told CBS News a little bit more about the unemployment report, specifically around wages.
Federal Reserve officials can remain confident looking at this report that they are satisfying the maximum employment component of their dual mandate. The big question is when and if they can begin to cut interest rates in the battle against inflation.
They're not. That's the thing. This news, and that's why I say the context around jobs is obviously good. But to be clear, they are saying they're not going to lower the rates. If they were to lower the rates, it's going to cause more inflationary problems, they say. I mean, the truth is when we're talking about bringing down rates and bringing down inflation, you have to have some level of economic discontent, some sort of economic vulnerability. Let's call it that. Otherwise, you're going to have the opposite effect. The stronger the economy, the higher the likelihood of inflation, at least in the context, again, of these very specific circumstances of putting a whole bunch of money, as they did, into circulation around COVID when it wasn't necessary. It ended up bringing down the value of the dollar. That's why you don't just print money. And that's a pretty basic 101 position that I'm pretty sure every, except I guess the Biden administration economists, believe. It is just odd to me, like super odd. And of course, what this does is kind of hide some of the other economic news that isn't so rosy. And that's what we spend a lot of time looking at, the not so rosy picture. Not because I'm a downer, although I am a Debbie Downer, generally speaking, but because there's lots of people who don't experience what it is that they're being told is the norm. And you have to take that into account. And there are still some people who, in any other world that wasn't dominated by inflation, a bit of uncertainty within the markets and the economy, if we didn't live in that world right now, these folks would be really, really, really screwed. Low-income Americans. And there was a story, I believe it was over at the National Desk, about how a lot of low-income Americans are stopping their, I don't know, weekly, bi-weekly trip to the Olive Garden. Olive Garden is a horrible restaurant that attracts people who are lower income, generally speaking. I know some people like their endless breadsticks and soup. Their soup looks nasty, just FYI, and you don't need the bread. But they're not shopping there anymore, or they're not going there for dinner anymore, at least not in the same numbers. Ricardo Cardenas, he's the CEO of the parent company Darden. He said during a recent earnings call that they're losing customers who make less than $75,000 a year. And that's how he is considering, or I guess that's his bar for quote-unquote low-income Americans making under $75,000. According to the news desk, they say the state of the current U.S. economy was a key topic of discussion during the earnings call, with, quote, inflation, end quote, being brought up a total of 24 times. And Cardenas said, again, nothing shocking here, totally expected, but he said, we're clearly seeing consumer behavioral shifts. The lower income consumer does appear to be pulling back. So they're choosing not to go to restaurants that are already pretty inexpensive, right? I mean, that's why you go to Olive Garden. You want cheap, semi-decent, at least hopefully seasoned pasta dishes. That's about it. And so this is obviously not a good sign. Again, if your constant message, and I mean constant message, is all about the economy. Because if people right now, let's say all the news is true, that not only are there more jobs, but the unemployment rate is truly down and it's not being impacted by an influx of new potential workers who are working under the table, I'm talking about migrants. If we're honestly looking at the numbers, okay, cool. That's good news. But also bad news. Specifically, has to do with, guess what? People are still complaining about an inability to afford some of their basic shopping items. And we are not talking about, I'm putting off my new big screen TV. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking very specifically about just the basics. Going to the grocery store, putting gas in your car. And again, depending on where it is that you live, things are either getting much better, or they're about the same as they were where you were first starting to complain. And yet again, not just an Olive Garden story making that point, but now you've got 99-cent only stores closing down every single one of their locations. Now, I don't know how many we have in Washington State, if any. I've never actually seen a 99-cent store, but we have versions of 99-cent stores. Kinda, sorta. I mean, maybe you can call grocery outlet a version of that. But they decided today to announce that they are closing all 371 of its stores. It's part of a, quote, orderly wind down. The CEO, Mike Simonic, said they've been under a whole lot of economic pressure that had, quote, greatly hindered the company's ability to operate. He said, unfortunately, the last several years have presented significant and lasting challenges in the retail environment, including the unprecedented impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, shifting consumer demand, rising levels of shrink, persistent inflationary pressures, and other macroeconomic headwinds. This was an extremely difficult decision, and is not the outcome we expected or hoped to achieve. So again, they're not able to stay in business. Now, obviously, the economics around a 99-cent store, just from an operational standpoint, is different than the economic concerns that you might have just as a consumer. But this does mean that people will have one fewer places to shop that they went to for deals because they're still struggling to get by, or they're just kind of on the cusp of getting into the struggle department. They're not there yet, but they feel like they're getting there. It's getting a little bit too close, too tight. So this is obviously not good news. Now, according to this story in The Guardian, they don't have any locations here in Washington. They have them in California, Arizona, Nevada, and Texas. And by the way, this comes with some significant implications here because you've got 14,000 employees who will be out of a job soon. And that's just from the stores. I don't know what it looks like from a job perspective at corporate. But we're talking about 14,000 employees are going to lose their jobs. And they'll be losing them in some places like Los Angeles, where the cost of living is very high. And so what do they do? Oh, well, good news. The economy is just rip-roaring. I'm sure they'll be able to find a job just like that. It'll be that easy. But again, no one really wants to have these bigger conversations. No one wants to talk about the unemployment numbers in Washington State, which are still higher than the national average. No one wants to talk about that, including the media, which you would think they would want to jump all over that story. 4.7% unemployment rate, that is high. That is really high. Now, will we get an updated number within the next, I think the next week? Yeah, hopefully it goes down. But understand, we were dealing with really high numbers that started to come down and then just got flat, right? I mean, when you think about during the height, and this is unfair from a historical perspective and just focusing on this, but just to give you a sense, we had record high unemployment during COVID, which makes total sense. I think the highest it was 16.7%. And that was right after COVID started, right in April, where we were getting the lockdowns and whatnot. Makes total sense. And then slowly things started to reopen, or at least be able to stay afloat because of various loans that were getting passed out for COVID relief. And then it started to come down and down and down and down. But it's still higher than the national average. And sure, we're doing better than where we've been sometimes in the past. But people keep talking about how things are amazing in Washington. Everything is well. Everyone is wealthy for the most part. And it's time for the wealthy to give their fair share back. Yeah, well, the numbers are a bit skewed in favor of high-paying jobs within the technology industry, construction, and healthcare. Hospitality as well. But folks who don't work in those industries, which are a lot of people, yeah, they are not finding the same kind of job opportunities as they used to. And again, this is worth talking about, but no one seems interested. And maybe because you're not interested. And if that's the case, now I feel bad having just done, 11 and a half minutes on this? Okay, fine, I'll move on. 1-800-465-8770 for your texts. 1-800-465-8770. Send me your text message thoughts. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show. Unfortunately, anti-Semitism is alive and well, not just in the Pacific Northwest, but of course we've been experiencing a heck of a lot of it, whether we're talking about on high school and college campuses or just the streets of downtown Seattle or downtown Kirkland or downtown Bellevue, where folks are marching with some pretty anti-Semitic messages. So a group of organizations got together and activists within the community got together to start a new campaign to call out hate, to call out anti-Semitism. And unfortunately, it's work we're going to have to be doing for a while now. Joining me on the line to discuss is Max Potashnik. She's the director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, we have conversations a lot about hate and bigotry, and you know, usually when it gets a little bit political, you get hashtags that say, let's call out hate against Black communities, against Asians, against the LGBT community. And it kind of feels like Jews, we just often don't get involved. We're never part of calling out the hate. I don't understand why that is.
Yeah. I think, you know, what we're really trying to do here, Jason, is draw some attention to the fact that anti-Semitism, as you say, is significant. It's on the rise. It's at the highest levels it's been in over 45 years in our country. And wanting to make sure that we name this hate for what it is, anti-Semitism, and making sure that we are being really explicit about calling it out. So that's one of the aims that we've got going here.
Does it feel like to you, because I have to say, I call out anti-Semitism a lot on the show, I do it a lot online, and in the back of my mind, I keep wondering if people are hearing the message and saying, my God, all he does is call out everything is anti-Semitic. And it's like, well, it's true. I'm doing it a lot because there just happens to be a lot of it to call out. And I don't know. Do you think that might get in the way of a message, maybe, you know, sending the message that, okay, they're just hypersensitive. They think everything is anti-Semitic.
Yeah. You know, I think you're touching on something. And one of the issues that we're trying to bring awareness to is that on the whole, even though the community, the Jewish communal experience today, overarchingly, is one of increased fear, lack of inclusivity, lack of feeling safe, both psychologically and physically, that there's a lack of recognition of that in the non-Jewish and in Jewish community in the general population. So while we see anti-Semitic incidents surging, while we feel what's happening, as you say, in our schools, on college campuses, in our workplaces, one of the reasons why there's such a lack of recognition of that is because a lot of people, more people than I think any of us know, really have a real lack of basic knowledge about mm-hmm. who Jews are, what anti-Semitism is, and how it works. And so it's really hard for people to call that out and to bring awareness to it and even bring that awareness ultimately toward action, which is what we're looking toward, if they don't even know what to look for. And so that's one of the core goals of our campaign, is really making sure that we're building awareness and not just awareness, but moving folks along really a ladder from awareness to taking action in that space.
Does it get more difficult because politics have unfortunately become intertwined with this? You know, talking about just Israel versus Hamas has become a political issue. I don't think it should be a political issue. I think you can have reasonable conversations about, you know, general disagreements, I suppose, with, you know, Israeli policy. But at the end of the day, you've got people who are coming from the fringes of both parties. But certainly here, I think it's clear we're seeing it from the fringes of the left. And I don't think Democrats hate Jews or hate Israel. I think quite the opposite, actually. But I think progressives have a problem right now. And I feel like that's the reason why too few people are actually calling it out here, because they happen to be Democrat and they don't want to be seen as like attacking their own. But they're not their own. These are people who are anti-Semites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, you're touching on some important points here. And right now we are living in an environment that's incredibly politically charged. What's happening with the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is horrific. I think everyone can agree on that. And everybody wants peace. I think that's something that we can also work toward.
Do you think that, just very quickly on that, do you get, just from hearing some of the voices who seem to be justifying the attack against Israel, do you think that they actually want peace? It seems like they actively don't want that.
You know, Jason, I'm not in the minds of folks, so I can't say exactly what people mean by that. I have seen some rhetoric that I think is concerning, but I think in this campaign, what we're trying to focus on is that really large group of individuals, the really strong middle, which I think spans the left and the right, yep, and the center, and building awareness around what is the difference between political speech, what is the difference between having an opinion, even, you know, a really strong opinion about what's happening in the Middle East right now, and how that doesn't have to be antithetical to creating safety for our Jewish communities here in the Puget Sound region. And by advocating against anti-Semitism, by bringing awareness to the growing problem of anti-Jewish harm, attitudes, biases, behaviors, that doesn't necessarily take away and shouldn't take away from the safety and of other groups as well. And so we're trying to be really specific and asking others to be really specific about their language. Like, one of the examples that we see a lot that I think most Jews receive as anti-Semitic, and also I would say perpetuates anti-Jewish harm and creates spaces where violence against Jews is permitted, is saying things like Zionism is Nazism. Yeah. Nazis are Zionists. Zionism is racism. And, you know, we've seen a whole slew of graffiti in the Seward Park neighborhood, which is one of the most historically Jewish and most observant Jewish neighborhoods in Seattle, as you know. And one of the stats that we understand is that, according to some polling done by an organization called the Benison Group, that came out recently, both pre-October 7th and post-October 7th, like almost 70% of the general population in the U.S. has never heard of the word Zionism mm-hmm. and has no idea what the word means. So when you have people using these signs like this, and that's why, you know, when you're saying, like, I think some folks, you know, the rhetoric around when folks are occupied, resistance is justified as terms of a justification for the violence. That's one of the phrases, and these phrases like Zionism is racism, that it's really important to dig into and explain and unpack to people why they are problematic, why they can cause harm. Because if you tell somebody who's not Jewish, I'll give you an example. Okay. I had a conversation with a leader in the Catholic community a few weeks ago. He was helping put on a forum for high school students and their parents to talk about what was happening in Gaza. And this is somebody who is incredibly well-informed, who has traveled to Israel, has traveled to the West Bank, has traveled all over the world, and has a deep history. He didn't know what Zionism means to most Jews. And by that, I mean, you know, that there is a need to and the right for the state of Israel to exist in some portion of our ancestral homeland, that that's not antithetical to the existence of also a Palestinian mm-hmm. state, that that doesn't have any implication about what your personal views are on Israeli government policies or, you know, what's happening in the West Bank or any number of those things. It just means that you believe that there's a need to and a right for the land of Israel to exist. And that is based on both a historical and a religious connection, and also thousands of years of systemic persecution that has shown that Jews are not safe. And so I think if you really unpack that and help people understand when they're using Zionist as a code word for Jew, really, because the vast majority of Jews believe, you know, that Israel is an important part of their Jewish identity, that starts to kind of unravel those threads and to say, hey, let's build some awareness around the language mm-hmm. you're using. Let's make sure you understand what the implications of that can be and how that can create a lack of safety for Jews here at home. And if you have a problem or a political statement you want to make, let's talk about how we could, how you can make that statement in a way that isn't going to perpetuate or cause anti-Jewish harm.
Precisely. We're talking, by the way, Max Potashnik. She's the director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle. We're talking about a new campaign that we hope starts to take off in a much more significant way to call out the anti-Semitism. It's the hashtag call it anti-Semitism and call out hate. To the point you just made, I mean, the only thing that keeps me at least somewhat sane is that assuming a good portion of the people who do, in fact, scream out the anti-Semitism, they legitimately don't understand what it is they're doing, that they're not necessarily, mm-hmm. you know, fueled by hate. There's a lot of people who are fueled by hate. There's no doubt about that.
Sure.
But there's also people who
they
just don't know what Zionism is. And I like the way you put it, because that's how I put it all the time. If someone's saying Zionist or Zionism, they just mean Jew. That's all that they mean in the context of how Jews hear the term being used.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, in terms of our objectives for this campaign, call out hate and call out anti-Semitism, we're really focusing on educating the public on what present day anti-Jewish attitudes, behaviors and actions look like mm-hmm. and centering what the lived experience of our community is. You know, I've received more phone calls than I've been at the Federation almost a decade now. And in the 4 months or so since October 7th to January 7th, I received more phone calls from parents, from students, from people in the workplace, from people in their neighborhood experiencing anti-Semitism than I had in the almost previous decade I've been at the Federation. And so it's important that we start to raise up those voices and tell people here at home, your Jewish community does not feel safe and is not safe. And here's what that looks like. And I think also, you know, creating some more unity in the Jewish community around this collective stance against anti-Jewish harm, and then trying to change what I call kind of the permission structure right now, right? As you say, you know, it's not very popular to be standing up for safety for Jews in the midst of the messiness that people feel about calling out anti-Semitism and how that's mixed in with the conflict right now. So trying to empower decision makers and thought leaders in education, in civic and elected space, you know, in the media and in other areas to really help them support one another, and business leaders as well, who say, look, I know what I'm seeing is not quite right. I don't know exactly what I should be saying and what I can be doing, and making sure that they have support they need, both from other leaders in their sphere, as well as Jews who are, you know, active in this space, and trying to help create a community of support for folks who are able and willing to take a stand. Because I think there are a lot of people. I think we just We need to tap into that and give them some support to do that and feel more comfortable doing that.
So your answer here has me wanting to ask a little bit of a tricky question. I promise it's not a trick question, but it's a little tricky because I approach this probably a little bit differently than you do. There are a lot of folks who come from groups like Jewish Voices for Peace, who use their Judaism, as they see it at least, as a way to attack Israel's right to exist. And I generally argue these are probably not even really Jews. They've not had a bar or bat mitzvah. These are just people who maybe had Jewish parents and maybe they grew up culturally Jewish, but have no real connection to Judaism. But clearly there are some who do have connection to Judaism, who are holding these views that are so antithetical to not just the Jewish faith, but the Jewish existence. So how do you treat those voices? How do you characterize them?
You know, I think that's a great question. And we are trying to, it's a hard question. Yeah. We're trying to create this campaign in such a way that it feels like it is an open and welcoming space for as broad a diversity of Jews as we can bring together. I'm going to say, for example, very transparently, like we didn't decide to put like a particular definition of anti-Semitism on the website because we want to focus on specific examples and lived experiences. And within the Jewish community, using specific definitions can get kind of messy. So that's one example. But you know, what I talk about numbers, I talk about vast majority, I talk about the JCRC. We are a network of 35 local Jewish organizations. Mm-hmm. We do our work through consensus building. We do not represent every Jew, and I never pretend to say we represent every Jew, but we represent where the consensus of the community is. And I think it's really important that leaders in non-Jewish spaces are able and willing and courageous enough to step up and listen to the majority of Jewish voices who say, look, Israel is a component of my Jewish identity. When you say something like Zionism is racism, it doesn't make me feel safe. And to choose Jewish voices that are antithetical to the very existence of the land of Israel and raise those up, that's tokenization. That's that's a form of anti-Jewish harm. And so I think, you know, it's not to say I'm more Jewish than you or my opinion, you know, matters. My personal opinion matters more than your personal opinion. But I like to stand on facts. And I stand on, you know, the Pew research and the collaboration and outreach and collective work that we do to talk about, when you're talking about the Jewish community, as small as it is and as diverse as it is, I'm speaking from a place of consensus, not precisely unanimity, but consensus. Yeah. And that's really important.
And when you look at polls, I mean, you're getting into the 92% range, depending on which poll you see, as Jews who identify with Zionism and, you know, can't separate Zionism from, you know, being Jewish and the Jewish identity. So, I mean, it makes it pretty clear. Again, we've been talking with Max Potashnik. She's the director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle. And we're asking folks to step up and call out the hate and call it anti-Semitism when you hear it. And the more people who do it, the more people will feel comfortable stepping up and saying, you know what, you're right. And I don't want to be silent anymore. Thank you so much for coming on and for taking on this important issue. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rancho. When we come back, we're going to dive into some quick hits.
The Jason Rance Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle top radio host Jason Rance. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rance is in focus now.
Jason Rance, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Well, a bunch of activists got together with a reporter over at The Hill who doesn't understand any of what it is he's talking about on the topic of decriminalization of drugs in Oregon, and you get the story that you might expect. Right. You've got a bunch of activists who appear to be the only ones this guy directly spoke to versus just quoting from, you know, some meeting that he might have seen online. And they're talking that just the headline just caught my attention. And it was sent out by The Hill via their, it wasn't their breaking news, but their more featured newsletter. It said, did Oregon pull the plug too soon on drug decriminalization? Now, that's a question that can only be asked by complete activists who are members of the cult that is progressive politics, the ones who can't see past their own ideology, and the dopes who think that this is something that they might want to bring to their own communities, right? Who are equally as fringe, but they live in areas that perhaps haven't dipped their toes quite yet into the crazy waters known as decriminalization or defunding, whatever it is. And in this case, it's funny because I think Joseph Choi, the writer, is based in D.C. He's either D.C. or New York. And actually, I think it was in D.C. So they haven't quite legalized drugs there, but they have pretty much legalized crime for the last 3 years, and now they're suffering the consequences of it. But they talk about this week, April 1st, the governor of Oregon, Tina Kotek, she signed the bill that was passed on a bipartisan basis that recriminalized drug use. It still has the effect once it actually gets utilized. And so far, you haven't really seen any results on the ground as far as police enforcement. And you're obviously not going to see anything on the ground as far as, you know, results of walking back that nightmare, at least in the short term. But it essentially says we're going to push you still into treatment instead of incarceration. And again, drug addicts will know that. They'll take advantage of it. They might not be able to take advantage of it as long as they previously did. But at the end of the day, they're going to have to actually not just offer toothless threats. But the story covers whether or not, according to the quote-unquote addiction experts in the state, whether this is really going to harm their position of wanting to get people treatment, even though they don't want to get people treatment. And the whole premise of this story is just lunacy, absolute lunacy. And they say in the article, addiction experts in the state say the decision to end Measure 110 about 3 years after voters passed the first in the nation law is misguided and misinformed. No matter what the results, they were always going to get in the way of rescinding the bill or overturning it, no matter the results. And we knew, and in the context of me saying that, I mean, whether the result was pretty much no difference than what it was a few years ago, which obviously is a negative because they have a massive drug problem as it is, or if it was, you know, 20 times worse than it is right now, they would still come to the same conclusion that everyone's misguided, everyone is misinformed, except, of course, the geniuses who thought it was appropriate to legalize drugs. And you're going to see a lot of this because there's a fear from the pro-drug legalization crowd on the far left that if the news out of Oregon actually starts to get a little bit better as it relates to drugs, that they're going to get in the way, Oregon will get in the way of the movement to legalize outside of the Pacific Northwest, right? I mean, you don't just have Oregon. You now have Washington State basically getting into the same exact position, slightly different circumstances when it comes to decriminalization, but the same end result, which is we decriminalized, a whole bunch of people then died as a result. And you can tie a ton of the deaths directly to this permissiveness, this permissive culture around drugs. You can tie a direct line. It's so easy to do because you can just look at the data. The data is what it is. And when you've seen this huge rise in death, in addiction, in Oregonians or Washingtonians saying they tried drugs for the first time, like it makes it really clear. It paints a clear picture. But of course, if you talk to the people who wanted to legalize in the first place, they have nothing but excuses and spin. For example, this guy talks to Tara Hurst. She's the executive director of Health Justice Recovery Alliance out in Oregon. She said, I think ultimately we had multiple crises hitting our state, unprecedented crises, not just crises, right, including but not limited to the pandemic that really crippled our state. And they were not able to respond to the overdose crisis and the houseless crisis at the same level as they should have. Oh, okay. The COVID did this. They said the $100 million in annual funding that the measure provided was often slow to reach those who could benefit. The pandemic forced some providers to close their doors or cut down capacity, and they struggled to maintain staffing levels that facilitated full usage of the funds. Quote, the dollars did not flow for 18 months, so we weren't able to get the investments that were so critical to meeting folks where they're at and keeping businesses, providers, treatment centers from closing at the level that we really needed. When they talk about meeting folks where they're at, sometimes they mean it literally. But oftentimes they mean it both literally and if you're an addict and you're not ready to quit, here is some drug paraphernalia. Here is a fentanyl pipe or a clean needle. Here are the tinfoils you need. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. These are folks who believe the crisis was the crisis because we didn't do enough harm reduction. We didn't do enough enabling of drug users to continue their addiction, but do it in a quote-unquote safer fashion because it would be done in full view of some health professional who can jump in case someone overdoses. Because that nothing screams safer or safe like needing a medical professional to be around to make sure you don't die. Got it. Now, the story is, I've now come to enjoy saying needlessly long because I think it says so much ironically. And that's what this story is. It's needlessly long. It's one-sided. It does a tremendous disservice to anyone who wants an honest look at what happened in Oregon. I wrote a book that covers a lot of these issues. I spent a lot of time in my chapter on drug decriminalization, specifically in Oregon. I believe it's chapter 2, I want to say. It might be chapter 3. It's called What's Killing America. The book is out now. It's on sale for $18.99 on Amazon. They paid me to write it and everything. And I hope you will purchase it. It's a book that I put a lot of energy into. And I hope it starts to make some changes, or at least convinces people to start making some change. There are stories in there that people, as much as you think you know all the madness that's been going on, including in the Pacific Northwest, even though the book's not just about the Pacific Northwest, understand there's a lot in there that no one has heard. And the first time they'll hear it is in the book, or you can get it on Kindle or audiobook. Again, it's called What's Killing America. What's killing me is the need to get to the commercial break, because I see producer Jackson giving me the eyeball. He's already learned how to give me the eye. I'm going. Okay, commercial, go.